Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 135 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by three co-hosts and one guest. First co-host is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Hey, hi. Good evening, guys. And 135. No wonder I'm so tired.
It's been quite a journey, hasn't it?
Yeah. Oof.
Also here is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog.
Hi. I'll have a large fry. wrong place. Hi.
Also with us is David Vanderhoof from the Just What Flew By blog and also the Hitchhiker's Guide to Military Aviation.
Good evening, afternoon, or whenever you are listening to this, folks. Hi, guys.
And our guest this episode is Gavin Werveloff.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Gavin, also known as the Travel Buddha on Twitter. It's good to have you back. Gavin's been on the show a couple of times before, and it's nice to have you back.
It's good to be here.
Coming up, we're going to talk about some of the aviation news from the past week. David is going to give us his This Week in Aviation history lesson. Stephen Grant have a rather lengthy Australia desk report. And Peter Johnson has an Across the Pond segment, so we're looking forward to that. And we've also got some listener mail. So let's start off with some aviation news. Is everybody ready?
I'm ready.
Ready in Chicago.
Our first story comes from Flight Global. This is by John Ostrower, actually. Boeing boss greenlights all new next generation narrowbody. Well, Jim McNerney, the CEO of Boeing, was at a conference, the Cohen & Company Aerospace and Defense Conference, and he had some interesting things to say. This is a quote. "We're going to do a new airplane. We're not done evaluating this whole situation yet, but our current bias is to not re-engine. Is to move to an all-new airplane at the end of the decade or the beginning of the next decade." So this isn't an absolute statement, but we've all been wondering whether Boeing was going to re-engine the 737 as Airbus is doing with the A320 class aircraft, or if they were going to wait and design an all-new narrow-body aircraft. This sort of sounds like they're leaning towards the latter. So, I don't know. Gavin, do you think this was expected?
Very much so. For a few reasons. The CFM56s that run on the current 737s, you see them, they look like they're sort of vertically squashed, right, in their housings. And, the 737 doesn't have as much wing clearance over the ground as an A320 class plane. And so in order to fit, for instance, a Pratt & Whitney GTF underneath the wing, they would have to do a bubble and raise the front landing gear to provide enough clearance so that they could put in different engines underneath the wing. Also, we're seeing this with Airbus and their Neo. It tends to play havoc with their backlog because all of a sudden they've got all these previously put in orders for A320s, and now everyone sees, oh, there's a Neo, but it's the same line. So we want to go to the Neo. And so it starts to eat up their backlog and creates a time crunch because previously placed orders now want the new engine. And it just creates all sorts of pressure on the airframer. And the third aspect of this is that it creates a caste system in the secondary market and the leasing market that you're either a new engine plane or not. And if it kills the resale values on – well, would kill the resale values on older CFM56 equipped 737s. So it's not a surprise at all. I think the writing was pretty much on the wall from the outset. It was just a sort of game of chicken with Airbus.
Do you think Boeing comes out ahead in that? I mean, the idea is that, Airbus is going to have something of value sooner, something of value to the airlines, that being – airplanes that have a fuel burn advantage and as well as noise and emissions. It's that versus waiting longer and getting a whole new aircraft, a whole new narrow body. It's difficult to judge, which is the best strategy.
I mean, I'm not running Boeing, but if it were me, I would have sort of scrapped this notion of trying to beat out Airbus on the tanker and just put all my eggs in getting the 787 going and then a 737 replacement.
Yep.
And try and do that sooner rather than later than going literally five rounds on the tanker.
Dan, if you were running Boeing, what would you have done?
Honestly, I think this is the right move for a couple of reasons. I'm trying to put my thoughts together because I usually view myself as the armchair CEO of an airline, not the armchair CEO of the airframer. I think it's the right move if based on the speculation that, yeah, it would be a bit more complex to re-engine a 737 as opposed to an A320. I think that's a good reason. But I think it'll be interesting to see what airlines move where, because the narrow body market, I mean, we have C-Series, which comes in a couple of years, then Neo in 2016, and this in the right now, the 2020-ish time frame. It'll be interesting to see like who orders it.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the big influencers here is what airlines have in their existing fleets already, because one benefit of the Neo is you have the more efficient engines, so you have the reduced fuel burn, but also since you're maintaining the airframe, you do maintain a decent amount of commonality benefits with existing A320 aircraft, which helps on the cost side. So it could help existing Airbus operators. So it's very interesting. Also, what I'm interested to see is, let's say Boeing continues on this path and formally announces a new program, exactly how big this aircraft will be. Because if you look at the 737 family, you have on the very small end the 600. Of the NGs, you have the 600 all the way up to the 900. And it'll be interesting to see if Boeing still produces, like, looks at an airplane even like the 600, which is, I guess, the closest to an A318. If they focus on the small side, will they go on the larger side? Because I would argue, or speculate rather, that on the narrow body side, while the 737-900ER is an interesting airplane, I don't think Boeing has right now a complete 757 replacement.
They really don't.
So it'll be interesting to see exactly what the capabilities of this airplane is and how big it will be. Of course, what engines are on it. One thing that John mentions in the article, you have the CFM LEAP EPIC, but also the Pratt & Whitney GTF. But in addition to that, the Rolls-Royce Advanced 3 engine, which is currently under development. So it'll be interesting to see what engine options are available for this aircraft. Especially because right now on the narrowbody side, the only narrowbody in production with Boeing right now is the 737, and there's one option, the CFM56. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out as well.
But, you know, one thing I think that's interesting here is we're talking about this all from a Boeing perspective, obviously, but it, as a potential customer from a potential customer aspect, don't you think that Boeing is going to have to deal with the fact that customers are going to say, oh, yeah, right, you're going to be able to deliver us a brand new narrow body airplane in 2020? Yeah, right. We've been looking at the way you handle the 787.
Well, I think the 787 definitely cast doubt on new airframes. I think that's certainly true. That being said, while the Neo is not a new aircraft, it's, you know, an adjustment on an existing airframe. You know, Airbus will have to see if Airbus delivers on time as well. An Airbus has had its share of delays with the A380, possibly.
I think you have to look at the source of them, though. I mean, the big part of the A380 problem was the integration and the different versions of the wiring software at different factories. This is not a different airframe. This is essentially the same airframe with different engines. And also, looking at the 787 production problems, it's primarily because of this extremely long logistical tail that's scattered around the world. I think both airframers will have learned their lessons from their respective issues.
Right. No. I completely agree. And of course, right now, none of the engines in question right now are in commercial service. So obviously, you have to watch that as well. So,
something interesting, Dan, that you said was that was the fleet commonality. But something else that has come up in other places, and I've heard about, and makes a lot of sense. You look at this Delta order that they're looking at putting in, and they've got a lot of planes that they're looking to replace on the 150 seat and smaller size. And that is, you know, in their DC-9s, MD-88s, and
right.
And then they've got this legacy Northwest fleet of A320s. And a very interesting possibility would be a combined C-Series A320neo order, with P&W, all with the GTF. And all of a sudden you get commonality there.
When I've been thinking about the Delta order, and actually I think I've actually come to a similar conclusion that you have. I've been thinking about the possibility of a split order as well. I think it depends if Delta wants to continue mainline flying on the smaller side, like what they did with the legacy Northwest fleet with the DC-930s and the DC-940s. Then again, I mean, what's the fun thing about all these mergers is when you look at both Delta Northwest and United Continental, you've had two very loyal Boeing customers in Delta and Continental merge with Airbus operators. So, I mean, I guess I wouldn't count Boeing, wouldn't count out Boeing completely for the future of Delta's narrow body fleet, especially in the longer term for maybe some of the aircraft that are not needing an immediate replacement. And I'm thinking very long term when eventually the 737NG gets long in the tooth, but that's a while out.
Let me ask you guys one more question before we press on, because I'm kind of interested in your thoughts on this. We have two strategies. Airbus strategy is to take an existing airplane and put more efficient engines on it. Boeing strategy would appear to be, now that we have these statements from McNerney, their strategy would appear to be, let's design a whole new aircraft with new engines, which offers the opportunity for better integration and some other kinds of improvements. But that's going to take a lot longer. So here's the question. Are both strategies viable, or is this a you bet your company kind of situation where there's going to be a winning strategy and one that is not so profitable? What do you think?
I think they're both viable. I think you have to look at the history of the 737. Even with NG and the varying phases, the basic structure hasn't changed all that much. And so you're still restricted in certain ways, i.e. the size of the engine. Also, another big advantage that the Airbus planes have is that they can take containerized cargo. And you look at a carrier like British Airways, who completely phased the 757 out of their fleet, I would argue earlier than they would have otherwise done, because it couldn't take containerized cargo, and their entire Terminal 5 operation is based around the notion of containerized cargo. Hmm. So I think the 737 needs replacing, and you sort of applaud Boeing for coming to that conclusion with a minimal amount of fuss. The A320 is a newer plane. And I think given its current parameters and current specifications, the Neo option does make a lot of sense for Airbus.
Hmm. Okay.
And I think from the from the airline side, it depends on each airline's needs. I mean, if I'm an existing Airbus operator, while the Neo is more of a derivative of an existing aircraft, so while it only has new engines and the airframe might not be completely optimized for those engines, I'll speculate on that. The commonality savings of keeping some commonality with the airframe might outweigh that.
And that's why the A320neo won out at Virgin America over, say, a C-Series or a 737 replacement.
Yeah, that actually is an interesting point. And the one thing I like to point out before we move on, if Boeing does do this and replaces the 737 outright, rest in peace 737 production line, which has been going for, I believe, over 40 years at this point. So it's a pretty solid run. And if this is fully replaced in 10 years from now, I mean, for that production, for the 737 to be in production for that long, that's pretty cool.
Sure. It's an impressive history. Okay. Yeah, let's press on. This is from the Globe and Mail. WestJet opens throttle in Eastern Triangle. Now, this article makes some pretty interesting statements. It says WestJet Airlines, which I believe is the second largest Canadian airline, WestJet Airlines is mounting a multi-pronged attack against Air Canada and Porter Airlines, Inc., declaring war against its rivals in an ambitious gambit to woo business travelers in the critical Eastern Triangle battleground of Toronto, Montreal, and Ottawa.
I think it's a very interesting move by WestJet to attract business travelers. I mean, these are some very busy routes in domestic Canada, and it's a very interesting proposal, business travelers. I mean, if you look, the flights, a lot of the flights are timed in both directions on the hour, frequent service, and some interesting incentives for travelers. For example, there will be no fees if you want to take an earlier flight. Also, if their aircraft, this is from a WestJet press release, but if a flight is delayed more than 30 minutes, passengers on those flights will get a 50% off on the next flight on that route. And if they get, and actually, this is a quote, if a guest flight is canceled and they cannot travel at the new time, they will receive full credit for the cost of the ticket plus 50% off their next Toronto, Montreal, or Toronto, Ottawa flight. Also, complimentary wine and beer on board, which is something that Porter offers, I believe. So, a very interesting change in product to compete with Air Canada, who from Pearson, I would say, has the the most compelling, very most frequent schedule, most frequent service. But what's interesting overall in this market is Porter Airlines has been building up an operation out of Toronto. I believe the name now is Billy Bishop Toronto City Airport, which is much closer to downtown Toronto, and they've been running a fleet of Q400s out of this airport. It's a very interesting little operation. The other interesting thing that's going on at this point is Air Canada did announce last year their intent to return to this airport to run actually Q400s as well out of this airport. But so far that service hasn't started yet. So it's just interesting to watch WestJet, which many view as a low-cost carrier. Well, it is a low-cost carrier, but you don't always see, it's sometimes hard to equate low-cost carrier, which is usually associated with leisure traffic, to an airline that's really working hard to attract business travelers.
Are they trying to pull a Southwest? I mean, would you say that they're trying to model themselves on Southwest? The way that Southwest moves between the Bay Area airports and the Los Angeles airports?
Not using this press release, they're not modeling themselves after Southwest. I mean, this is a very aggressive press release that they put out. I'm not saying that there's not a battle in the airline industry, but I mean, this company has made it really clear that they're going to pull out all the stops and do whatever they need to try to crush Porter. I believe it was in this news release that they were talking about really, really, really cheap fares. And, you know, to me, I don't know, maybe it's me, Dan, maybe you and Gavin might disagree, but whenever a carrier starts looking like it's all about price and it's war and they're going to go for the jugular, it always seems to make me think that company's in some serious trouble.
I would disagree.
Especially in this case.
Yeah. Not saying that airlines can make moves of desperation when they're in trouble. But I think WestJet is a very successful airline, and I think they're just repositioning themselves to become more competitive in this market. And
but you
I
know
just,
what? As a business person, I'm not impressed. I mean, of course, maybe that's obviously just me, but if I were a business person and it looked like it was an airline at war with somebody else, that doesn't make me feel warm and fuzzy. I don't want to be in an airplane that you know is at war with its competitors. I just find that business.
But you, sir, I'm trying to get my Keith Olbermann on, sir,
because he's off TV at the moment. Someone's got to channel him.
Are a loyal Southwest frequent flyer. Yet for so many years, Southwest did make a point of saying, look how much cheaper we are than our competitors. So,
yeah, well, maybe. I don't know. I guess I was reacting more to the, Not so much just the dollar figure lingo, but the warfare part.
Yeah,
that's the part that's making me feel a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, I mean the warfare line. I mean that's from the news article, not from the press release.
Oh, I see. Okay, never mind, WestJet. Sorry.
Yeah, the Globe and Mail thing. That's a news article. But I think, I mean, WestJet will certainly compete on price, but I think they're making some enhancements, like, for example, the compensation for delays, the complimentary beer and wine. So they're making efforts on the product side as well to fly.
I think they're also trying to wind up Air Canada. WestJet would not oppose more slots for Emirates. I mean...
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, I think... Well, where
is that coming from? Where...
More related to the story.
Okay.
Up at the top there. And then also, interesting enough, with British Airways, who already serve, I think they serve Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, and possibly Calgary. I'm not sure, though.
Well, who knows? Actually, I just clicked on the article that you posted. WestJet envisages signing up Emirates Airlines as a partner in the long term. So that's interesting. But I mean, WestJet has had some interesting interline agreements as well. Actually, they recently announced an interline partnership with Delta. So,
Okay, let's talk about the TSA a little bit. Things seem to have kind of quieted down with the TSA. I mean, we haven't heard as much about scanning and groping as we did for a while there. But there is something brewing, and that's whether or not the TSA airport screeners are going to form a union. So we have this article from Air Transport World. TSA sets framework for airport screeners to collectively bargain. Department, the U.S. Transportation Security Administration head, John, is that Pistol?
It's Pistol.
It's Pistol.
Like the gun, yeah.
Like the gun. Well, John Pistol has said he's made a decision that, quote, provides a framework to allow TSA's airport screeners, and that's more than 60,000 of them, to unionize, quote, for the purposes of engaging in limited, clearly defined collective bargaining at the national level only on non-security employment issues. That's nice. John Micah, who is a Republican from Florida, who heads the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, he's the chairman of that committee, he said in a statement that unionization would turn over, quote, airport screening to the Obama administration's union cronies, with the airport screening force mushrooming from 16,500 in 2001 to now nearly 63,000. This will be President Obama's biggest gift to organized labor.
Holy hyperbole, Batman.
Yeah.
But you know what I thought was interesting too was that other story where they quoted Pistol as saying that while on the one hand he certainly understood the collective bargaining process, he was not going to let this get out of hand in any way, shape, or form, and would not be opposed to firing TSA screeners, just like the Reagan. Ronald Reagan did to the controllers back in 1981. And what I thought was most interesting about that is he was very angry when he said that. So I mean, most government officials don't like unions. So, I mean, that's not anything too strange. But what I don't think he understands is that the reason they are probably forming a union is because he is that way with them.
Yeah.
And that's the part that didn't come out in the story that I thought we should mention.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, people don't just form a union because they wake up one morning and think that might be a nice idea, a nice thing to do. I mean, they're being pushed in that direction in some way or other.
Look at what happened after the controller strike in 81. I mean, NATCA, the current air traffic control union, came about, I believe, about 4 years later, in the wake of the strike, and and they didn't seem to get that. They didn't understand why it had come to be.
What I find interesting here, for a couple reasons, is, and maybe this is part of Pistol's framework, but how much, if the TSA ends up unionizing, how much will it affect airport screenings for passengers, and also, worst case scenario, what happens if they strike?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, they wouldn't strike. They could. I mean, they shouldn't. I mean, that's the oath that they all take. But I think too that everybody needs to realize is they can't argue. I'm sorry, they can't bargain for anything related to airport security. Essentially, it's very much like what the controllers have. It's working conditions. It's schedules. It's vacation. It's seniority. To the people, it's dress codes. Of course, they all wear uniforms, but I mean, those are the kinds of issues they're going to be able to bargain with, and nothing else. And so, would they strike? Well, of course, nobody thought the Patco guys would strike either, but they did.
And look where it got them.
Yeah, and I doubt seriously that these people would strike over anything.
I'm just very. I feel like. This is not sort of indicated by this whole thing with the collective bargaining, but I'm definitely among those who feel like the TSA and the secure airport security regime in this country, I'm not sure who runs it and who gives it its direction. And there are certain things that sort of drive me nuts about it, and maybe it's being overly politically correct, but it infuriates me that, A, we don't have a trusted traveler program, and B, our current system isn't back-checked against anything, you know, such as people who've already been background-checked for varying reasons. And so, you know, everyone is treated like they could turn into a terrorist at any moment in time.
But that's why there is no trusted traveler program. They don't trust any of us. No, seriously, though. I mean, but that should be coming from Janet Napolitano. That strategy should be coming from Department of Homeland Security, and maybe it's not. I mean, let's be serious. When you go to an airport, every airport does it differently. At least that's what I found. I mean, I had to take my belt off in Nashville to get through the security machine, and I asked why. They said because we told you to, and I said, well, how come they don't ask me to do that at Midway? Well, because we're not Midway. And I mean, it's not a big deal, but I'm just saying that if you can have so many little differences on a local basis, it's not so surprising that there seems to be no congruent philosophy there for how to run this damn thing.
Well, but I take off my belt every time, I like to add.
Well, and the other thing is that you combine this unionization push with this whole with the revocation of airports to be able to hire their own security companies rather than use TSA screeners, and you start to ask, well, where is this going to lead to?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting point. I was going to raise that, but now you said the revocation. Now, the way I understood it, maybe I got it wrong. I thought it meant, at least the way I read it, that they were going to be able to start hiring their own and eliminate the TSA. Did I get that wrong?
No. Before airports could, and I think, Gavin, the biggest airport that does this is SFO.
Exactly.
And I believe the ruling now at this point is that no additional airports will be able to change.
Yeah.
Mm-mm-mm.
Which combined with this push to unionize, you know, this is far too important to be left to politics. And that's my big fear, is that if every airport in the country has to be staffed by the TSA, and the TSA are getting, you know, the employees are getting more and more collective power, the threat of a strike is enough to cripple our ability to move people from one country, from one point in the country to another. And that gets me a little nervous.
Hmm. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure I share that. Only because I think if they really wanted to affect the – I mean, I guess, again, what are they collectively bargaining for? I mean, again, why is there going to be a union? And my guess is that if TSA has run anything like FAA is, who I spent 10 years of my life with, I know why they have a union because they treat people like dirt, and they just don't ever seem to quite understand that. And people get very frustrated with that, even though there are 65,000 of them right now. And they, you know, we think, well, heck, times are tough. They should be happy they have a job. And I mean, that only goes so far. And
I think, and the flip side is that I think right now, especially given the state of a lot of states and municipalities' finances, people are heavily on guard for unionized public employees, and it's a special sensitivity at this point in time. And maybe this will all turn into nothing, or maybe it will turn into something. But I think to not acknowledge that sensitivity would be wrong.
Gavin, we were talking before the show a little bit, and you mentioned that you had written a column about the greening of the airline industry.
Yeah, there's a blog, and they're on Twitter, called Green Growth Cascadia, and it's run by a bunch of, believe it or not, civil engineers who all tend to work in the transportation sector. Most of it is non-aero related. It's buses and high-speed rail and municipal rail and things like that. They all work for various big engineering firms, and they asked me to write a column about the greening of the aviation business. And I started out by talking about Plane Stupid, who are the group out of England who just sort of want to kill off aviation, and they break into Stansted or Luton or wherever they can and just cause everything to come to a screeching halt.
Yeah, it's a pretty activist organization, right?
Yeah, and they're very active, and I don't think they have a lot of thought about which way they're headed. They're just they move very quickly, but direction is questionable. And a lot of people don't realize, especially with oil having passed through $100 a barrel last week, although given Friday's events, I think it'll settle back down below there. The interests of the environmental movement and the interests of the airlines themselves are very much aligned in the fact that they want to use as little fuel as possible to move as many people as possible as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. It's a financial motivation.
Oh, 100%.
Instead of, in most cases, instead of some, sense of altruism.
No, 100%. We go off on airlines a lot, but they've got a very tough time because they have high fixed equipment costs and they have high labor costs. And, in all this, they have to, remain going concerns. And fuel plays a very large part of that. And so if they can cut down the amount of fuel they use on a route, it can make a difference at the end of come quarter end between making a profit and making a loss.
How much does their motivation swing based on the changes in the price of oil? Does their enthusiasm wane every time the price of oil goes down? Or have we reached a point where they are sort of committed to sort of the long run and higher fuel prices?
Well, it's interesting because going back to 2008 when oil peaked and then plummeted, you had a lot of airlines who got caught going the wrong way in both directions. They didn't hedge enough. Oil spiked. They got hammered. And then 3 months later, oil bottomed out and they'd hedged and were paying far more than market for fuel again. So I think controlling their exposure to oil prices is definitely – it was that 1-2 punch, I think, that made them very much aware. And also the fact that Southwest ate everyone's lunch in 2008 because they were adequately hedged.
Okay, interesting.
And also, I went on to talk about NextGen, and this was before you had on I'm forgetting his name, but the episode on RNP, the gentleman from Navarus.
Steve Fulton.
Yeah, that was a fascinating episode. But, just talking about GE, granted, GE is the one doing all the implementation.
Yes.
But they're talking about 10 to 15% fuel reductions from a continuous descent approach or an RMP-based air traffic control system, which is a lot of fuel savings.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So it's definitely somewhere, and it's one of these things that keeps on getting kicked down the road. I think did it get tabled as part of the FAA reauthorization this time around, or are we still actually going to do it this time?
Mm.
Anyone? I remember seeing it.
I believe it's still it's a very significant priority for FAA to get next gen rolling. In fact, I just saw something. What was that, guys? About the an increase in fuel taxes for aviation in general, all focused on next gen.
Oh, on as a means of funding it?
Yeah, I saw that last week. I can't remember the details though.
But even the military, I mean, David, even the military is seeming to be, you know, more and more interested in biofuels and blends and so forth as something that they see in their future.
Well, I think it's a necessity, not necessarily they want to. It's just a matter of, I think they're going to have to, you know. If we start losing countries left and right in the Middle East that are no longer going to be friendly to us, where are we going to get that oil? So, and how are we going to defend them once, if we don't have any oil to defend them? So, it's one of those things.
So it's a different motivation for them, for the military.
Yeah, it's a different motivation. It's not financial. It's a matter of we need to have
availability.
We need to be able to do what we need to do if there's an oil crisis. So.
Gavin, how about American Airlines? And, you know, they seem to be sort of, you know, picking a fight with the GDSs.
It's really a fascinating situation for me because I'm trying to figure out why they're doing it. And I've spoken to other people in the industry, and there's a sort of, well, we get why they're doing it, but why now? And why are they, why are they picking a fight with everyone? Southwest is unique in the sense that, you know, their tickets are only available on their website, but they have an incredibly loyal flyer following. You know, people love flying Southwest. They've got a different attitude. American Airlines has a very high frequent flyer membership. They have a lot of elites. They have a lot of people who push serious mileage. And for whatever reason, and it has to be implicit in this, that they're going to maintain their customer loyalty, because if they're off Orbitz, they're off Expedia, they're off all the GDS-based ticket purchase outlets, they're going to need that loyalty to stay afloat. Not to say that I think they're being completely off the mark, because to be quite honest, they've been ahead of the game numerous times in terms of Sabre, and I'm forgetting the name of the other one. They have a history going back of
Travelport. Is that who you're talking about?
Yes, that's it. That's it. Travelport. They have a history of sort of being trailblazers in these booking systems. It makes sense. What doesn't make sense is how antagonistic they're being.
Yeah.
Because to be quite honest, they do have a point in the sense that airline tickets, there isn't the ability to customize the travelers. You know, you can't prepay baggage fees if you buy a ticket through Expedia, whereas you can if you go to AmericanAirlines.com or AA.com. Mm. So they do have a point. It's just sort of wondering why now and why so antagonistic.
Well, maybe they feel they've caught up with the Expedias and the Travelocities in terms of the experience that they can give to the passengers. I mean, before the airlines really couldn't step up to it, and I think these other travel sites, you know, filled a need that the airlines couldn't. And maybe American thinks that, hey, they can do that now, so why do you need this middleman?
A couple of interesting things to point out. First, with Southwest and only being able to book online, Brett Snyder had an interesting post back in November and about booking only through Southwest.com. And he was writing about how a poll that and he had some interesting poll results about why Southwest, you know, needs to emphasize the fact that you can only book on Southwest, because 32% of people who polled thought you could book Southwest on Expedia. So it's very it's interesting. So Southwest, I mean, has run ads saying, "Hey, you can only book us on Southwest.com," and I mean, this is, if this continues to be an objective for Southwest, clearly this must be a challenge for American as well. But it's, I mean, I've seen some internet ads. I'm sure you guys have seen the same by Americans saying, "Hey, look, you can't book us on Expedia and Orbitz anymore." If they're effectively getting their message out, that's another question. What's also interesting in terms of ancillary revenue, there could be some progress in that area, because at the end of January, U.S. Airways and Expedia announced a new agreement. And part of the press release was that Expedia and U.S. Airways would be working together to offer U.S. Airways' Choice Seats product, which is basically you're paying for a slightly nicer seat in the coach cabin. So it could be a window seat in the towards the front of the cabin, so you get on and off quicker. So it's interesting to see that little change. So there could be some more ancillary revenue coming through. But, you know, I think this is a this is definitely a very interesting issue for the airline industry, because GDS is, you know, you have to pay for that distribution. So there's a cost side to it, but also airlines would like to get as much ancillary revenue as possible. And a lot of that revenue is right now. I mean, if a lot of those fees can't be paid on other travel websites like Expedia, that's lost revenue on the table as well. And also, if airlines would like to go to their own website, so you can just book all the flights, they don't have to pay the GDS, but then you could, you know, book rental car, hotel, and such, because the airline can get a little bit off the top there as well. So, I mean, I it's very interesting to see American take such a drastic move. It'll be interesting to see how it all works out.
Well, you know what's going to happen next, though, don't you? On the international flights or the long flights, the American's going to start charging for the entertainment system.
Oh, you think?
I would be. I just can't believe, honestly, that some of these carriers have not done that. I mean, they charge for Wi-Fi.
Well, some airlines do charge. Like, for example, I believe Gavin is going to know better than me, but I'm pretty sure, like, on Virgin America, TV is free, but if you want to watch a movie, you're going to have to pay. So I think for long haul flights, who knows? Because I think entertainment.
I doubt that. I severely doubt that. Especially in after the tie up. Well, I mean, at least for American, I doubt that, because especially after the tie up with BA and Iberia, they want to harmonize their onboard offerings as much as possible.
Yeah.
And if American started charging, that would be a big turnoff for BA Iberia, who are now under the same ownership.
I think if you see any charging, it would be sort of like what some other carriers have done, which is you get some entertainment for free, and you would pay for some form of premium entertainment.
Hmm. I mean, Delta does it on domestics.
Yeah, and I think Continental, you pay for TV as well.
Delta, their domestic 763 and most of their 752 fleet are AVOD equipped and have satellite TV. And satellite TV is free, but certain shows are you have to pay for unless you're in the premium class.
All right, Gavin, folks can find you on Twitter, right, as travel_Buddha?
Yes, that is where you can find me. And also intermittently on Dan Webb's blog.
Yeah.
Yes, do it more often. Gavin always has some interesting posts. So.
All right. Well, great. Gavin, thanks for joining us. Are you going to be able to stick around?
Yeah.
Okay, good. How about you, Rob? Do you have to peel off and attend to your students? Or?
Yes, I'm afraid I do. So, listen, you guys have fun. Gavin, thanks for being with us tonight. And I'm sorry I can't stay to hear how nice and sensitive Dan's going to be for the rest of the evening.
All right. Let's talk to you next week, Rob.
Night, guys.
Have a good night.
Bye.
Good
night, everybody.
I'm feeling the need for some history. So why don't we talk to David? David, are you ready?
Always.
So now, with This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 3, Episode Number 5, February 13th through the 19th. February 14th, 1963. The Indian Air Force received its first McCoy & Gervich MiG-21 Fishbet from the Soviet Union. The MiG-21 was the first supersonic fighter for the IAF. The reason why the MiG-21 was chosen was that the Soviets offered to complete technology transfer and that the Indians could build their own MiG-21s. Eventually, Hindustan Aeronautics Limited, or HAL, built almost all of the 21s. 657 MiG-21s were built by HAL. 12 MiG-21s had scored kills in air-to-air combat with Pakistan's air forces. Now, how does history repeat itself? If you've been following the news, Aero India 2011 is occurring, and the Indians are looking for a replacement for the MiG-21. Some of the candidates are the F-16IN, the Sea Typhoon by the F-18EF International, all of which have one requirement by the Indian Air Force, and this is one that repeats itself. The aircraft must be built in India, and they must have a complete technology transfer. If the Russians, the Americans, or the Brits and the Europeans, whoever wins, the Indians will be building the airplanes. from the Guess We Were Wrong files. On February 16th, Trajan Vuja, a Romanian, presents a paper to the Academy of Sciences in Paris, France. His paper showed how his gasoline-powered engine would lift his monoplane design. His paper was rejected, and the reason being was the following quote. The problem of a flight with a machine that weighs more than air cannot be solved and is only ever a dream. Vuja, like every good inventor, went on to prove the naysayers wrong. On March 18, 1906, he took off flying the first monoplane with a wheeled undercarriage. From our The Military and Government Always Do It Can Do It Better files, February 19, 1934, President F.D. Roosevelt issues Executive Order 6591. EO 6591 ordered the War Department to put under their discretion of the Postmaster General, quote, such airplanes, landing fields, pilots, and other employees and equipment of the Army of the United States needed to require for the transportation of mail during the present emergency by air over routes and schedules prescribed by the Postmaster General. This was the result of what was called the airmail scandal. The Airmail Act of 1930 during the Hoover administration awarded all mail contracts to three airlines. United Airlines for the northern routes, Transcontinental and Western Airlines, or TWA, for the center of the country, and American Airlines for the southern routes. In 1933, lawsuits were filed, and the Roosevelt administration determined that the contracts were bought and dissolved them. To handle the crisis, the Army created the AACMO, or the Army Air Corps Mail Operation. Interesting enough, some famous names came out of the AACMO. Lieutenant Colonel Henry Hap Arnold, Lieutenant Colonel Horace Meekum Hickam, and Brigadier General Oscar Westover. Now, the first flights for the AACMO were made using Boeing P-12Es carrying 50 pounds of mail each. So that would be the equivalent of the U.S. Postal Service using F-18s. The emergency lasted until June 6, 1934. The results of the AACMO were as follows. There were 66 accidents, which caused 12 crew deaths. In 78 days, 13,000 hours, with a completion average of 65%. 777,389 pounds of mail were delivered at the time. The always outspoken General Billy Mitchell said this about the mail fiasco. If we are fortunate enough to be drawn into another war, the Air Corps wouldn't amount to much. If it's not equal to carrying the mail, I would like to know what it would do with carrying bombs. Now, to honor our discussion earlier this evening, and I kept my mouth quiet about the Boeing 737, we have this. February 19th, 1965. Boeing signs its first customer for their newest twin-engine jet, the Boeing 737-100. Lufthansa is the launch customer. Lufthansa agrees to purchase 22 at a cost of $65 million. As a current comparison, a 737-900 costs $85 million apiece.
Wow.
Lufthansa's first airplane was to be delivered on February 10th, 1968, slightly less than 3 years from contract to delivery. When did ANA sign that contract for the 787, and when did it take delivery? Oh, wait, you're right. It hasn't. I long for the good old days. First fights that occurred during the week of February 13th through the 19th. February 14th, 1978, the Cessna 303 Clipper, light twin. February 14th, 1942, the Douglas R4D or C-54 Skymaster. Douglas liked the date, so on February 15, 1946, Douglas DC-6 or C-118 Liftmaster first flew. On February 15, 1986, my favorite aircraft of all time, the Beach Starship, took to the skies. On February 19, 1957, the Bell X-14 Vistol experimental aircraft first flew. And last but not least, Dan's favorite airplane. On February 19th, 1982, the Boeing 757 first took to the skies.
Ah, beautiful.
And that's Thank the you. Way it was February 13th through the 19th. This is David signing off.
David, how much did you say the 7-3 cost back in the day?
I paid like $65 million for 22.
Yes.
Just under $3 million.
Yes.
So we'll call it $3 million apiece?
Yes.
So if we adjust that for inflation...
You've got your little calculator again, don't you?
Yes. According to an inflation calculator, $3 million in 1965 is the equivalent to about $20,186,000, $472.85.
So still a fraction of what it costs.
Yeah, I was going to say, still quarter of the cost of a Boeing 900.
Right. No, it's interesting. Though it would, though, is the 737-100 an equivalent to, what's the list price of a Boeing 737-600?
I didn't look that up.
We don't know.
$50 million, $58 million. So
supposedly. It's still cheap.
But
how long does it take you to get a delivery, Dan, of a 737-900?
I don't know when the end of the backlog is for all.
So you got to admit, $65 million for 22 airplanes in the first airplanes arriving to them in 3 years.
No, that's a good deal. That's like the dollar menu of airplanes.
I'm with you. It seems like development cycles have gotten longer and more expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at how quickly things got built and how effective they were in the Cold War from the military side. And then you look at, F-35.
Well, yeah, complexity is up. And so,
100%.
I don't know.
We should ditch the computers and go back to slide rules.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, February 13th, 2011.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 135 of the Airplane Geek Show. Grant, boy, I tell you what, it's been a busy news week for aviation in this part of the world this week.
Oh, it certainly has. It looks like the airlines and the Air Force and everyone are trying to make up for some quiet times over the last few months.
Absolutely. Well, it gives us lots to talk about. Now, we've got a couple of briefs we're going to go through first, and then we're going to go into the big news of the week, which is some looming industrial strife at Qantas.
That's right. But first up on Qantas once again, last week we were talking about the whole fuel surge charges situation, and thanks to the guru at Flight Wisdom blog who wrote into the Airplane Geeks and pointed out that the US does actually have fuel surcharges. It's just that they're buried inside the tickets and aren't allowed to be reported on separately. Thanks for that. I didn't realize that you did have them in there. Here in Australia, they are there, and there are ways you can bring up and see what the surcharges are. Typically, when you're on most airline sites, though, they just show you a flat fee, including all surcharges and taxes. But at the moment, though, Qantas has decided to not only increase the surcharges they were last week, now they're also up increasing domestic airfares. And again, they're saying it's due to fuel.
It just goes to highlight the point that I was attempting to make last week. And, I guess perhaps I wasn't clear, but I actually like the way they do it in the US. It should be just buried in the price. Let's face it, a major component of any ticket is the cost of the fuel. And the idea that Qantas will charge you for the fuel and then charge you for the fuel again, I find ridiculous. And now here they are increasing their base fare because of fuel, and then increasing their fuel surcharge on top of that. So it's to me, it's double dipping. So one of many, many Qantas stories this week, Grant.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure there's some complex reason they're able to pull out that says, oh, no, for these fares, we don't have a surcharge. For these ones, we do, et cetera, et cetera. But all that pales into insignificance against Air New Zealand's new all-black A320, which is not only the newest one in their fleet, and not only painted to support the All Blacks rugby union team, but it also has a Pico cell on board that allows your mobile phone to do voice, text, and email while you're flying. Once you reach cruising altitude, the Pico cell switches on. You're allowed to turn on your phone, and that keeps your phone running at a lower energy level, so it's not putting out as much interference. Of course, that doesn't mean that it's free. It's going to cost you quite a bit of money, I would say, to use that. They're not cheap, but it also means that now you get to interfere with other passengers by talking on the mobile phone. And if we all know that everyone talks louder on a mobile phone because they can't hear themselves back in their ear to save battery power, mobile phones don't play your voice when you're talking to someone like a normal phone does. So people naturally start to talk louder on a mobile.
Talking about the cost to use the service, looks like it's provided by Vodafone, and they're charging flight roaming costs of 80 cents. This is in New Zealand currency, 80 cents per outbound text and $3.50 New Zealand per minute to make a call.
Ouch.
And boy, $20 per megabyte of data. So boy, you'd really want to meet it if you needed to make a call using that Pico. So interesting technology,
yeah.
Though.
Yeah, those prices are quite high. For example, here in Australia, you get charged about 20 to 25 cents to send an SMS. So yeah, that means they've got quite a premium on that service. So you definitely don't want to use it too much. But look, you know, speaking of premiums and costs and things like that, there's indications that Rolls-Royce may be holding back on the level of compensation to Qantas for the famous A380 incident. According to Merrill Lynch, they estimate that Qantas has had an impact of approximately $207 million Australian, $70 million directly to repair the aircraft, and $137 million in lost income costs associated with hoteling people and leasing aircraft to pick up the downtime while the A380s were all grounded. However, Rolls-Royce are reporting that they see it as being only $90 million Australian. So, sounds like there's going to be a bit of a squabble going on there soon.
Well, I tell you what, Qantas's dispute resolution teams are going to be working in overdrive, for I reckon, for the next several months.
Yeah, well, maybe they can put them in that second A380 simulator. Although I note that it's not in Jetstar colours, it's still being considered a Qantas simulator.
Yeah, it says here in an article in Australian Aviation this week that Qantas has ordered a second, what they're saying here is a CAE 7000 series Level D full flight simulator.
Ooh, I'd love to get in that.
Yeah, we ought to organise that, Grant.
Yes, I think we should start talking to our friends at Qantas, although after today's report, they may not be our friends anymore. Maybe we should stick to our friends at the RAF. Yeah, one of the RAF's PC-9 training aircraft had to abort its takeoff in RAAF Pearce in Western Australia after an engine failure on takeoff, and flames were actually observed coming out of the engine. So at the moment, the fleet is not grounded, but flight operations are suspended.
The PC-9 has been an extremely reliable aircraft for the Royal Australian Air Force over the last, let's say, 20 years that it's been here, primarily used as a training aircraft, also used for some forward air control duties as well. Moving on to the big story of this week, the Qantas Pilots Union, the Australian and International Pilots Association, have been in talks with Qantas management for quite some time, we believe, over a new enterprise agreement. Their last enterprise agreement expired at the end of last year, and Qantas pilots, let's face it, have really been looking for a better deal. And this dispute, depending on who you want to listen to, is not so much over pay, it seems. It's more over job security. And given that some of the changes in the Qantas group that we've been talking about for a long time here in the Australia desk, I can't say that I blame Qantas mainline pilots for being a little bit concerned about the way things are going.
Yeah, Steve, I mean, job security is difficult for anyone in this world these days, but they do have some valid complaints. And here to start things off is Qantas spokesperson Olivia Worth. We heard her on Radio 3MTR.
We obviously want to provide job security for all our employees, not only for our pilots. And the best way to secure job security for the pilots is to make sure that we can get our international business back on track. The average pilot has been working with Qantas for 20 to 25 years. We haven't made a Qantas pilot redundant in 41 years. So there is a significant amount of job security that's been with the business. The case that our CEO, Alan Joyce, made today to the pilots was that we need to work with our pilots. We need our pilots on board. They're absolutely critical for our business. But job security can only be provided if we get our international business up and running, if we get it back on track.
Which is a mouthful of words there, Grant. And really, to my way of thinking, that's just a lot of spin, which I guess, in fairness to Ms. Worth, is what she's paid to do. and I noticed actually in those opening comments that she made there, Grant, that she's really talking about the past and not the future. I mean, okay, great, they haven't made anyone redundant in 41 years and all that sort of stuff, but that's really not what any of these forward-looking disputes are about, in my view. They're more about what's happening in the future.
Correct. And, as she's saying, they need their pilots, they rely on them and so on. Well, Alan Joyce was making a big thing about how great and well-trained and highly skilled Qantas pilots are at the time of the A380 incident. And yet now he's turning around and saying, well, actually, we want you all to be at the Jetstar level, where pilots are not paid as much.
Here's what Olivia Worth had to say about the way Qantas management is viewing the claims made by the union.
I guess the point of difference here is that the pilots were seeking, as part of their contract, that the only Qantas pilots would be operating Qantas group flights, and that includes Jetstar, it includes Jetstar Asia. So that is not part of the negotiation. That is not on the table, and it's not up for discussion. We absolutely want to provide security, but security is by us working together with the pilots and getting our international business back on track. They're also seeking a significant pay rise of 8.5%, which is obviously unreasonable, and there was some discussion of that today as well.
Now, that's really interesting because that figure of 8.5% is disputed by Barry Jackson, the president of the union, as we'll hear in a minute. He's saying they only want about 2%, which is actually below the consumer price index at the moment, the inflation rate.
The figure is that's going around, the union is asking directly for 2.5% per year as an increase, and that's immediately being thrown around as actually an 8.15% effective increase per year by Qantas. That not 8.5, but 8.15. is what they said in articles, because what they're saying is that if you include category changes and also your travel allowances and things like that. But there's also figures being thrown around of 14.4% over 3 years and even 26% over 3 years. And it's all getting really confusing. And all it's reminding me is that there's lies, damn lies, and statistics, something that our friend Dan knows very well.
The interesting thing here, and I mentioned this at the top here about job security, and here's what Captain Barry Jackson from the Australian and International Pilots Association, here's his take on it.
The bottom line for us is that we're concerned, the pilots themselves are concerned about job security. That was our main thrust. We see a lot of subsidiaries, be it Jetstar, Jetstar New Zealand, wherever you care to mention, a lot of growth outside the Qantas Group, and our members are concerned about the offshoring of an Australian icon.
And we've talked about that before, and particularly, Grant, with regard to the New Zealand subsidiary, Qantas Jet Connect, and as we've mentioned before, those aircraft come in and out of Australia from New Zealand. They're painted in Qantas colours, and they use Qantas flight numbers, but it's a separate business unit, and obviously they're paid on a completely different and separate enterprise agreement, and for considerably less than Qantas mainline pilots are being paid for. So you can see why that's attractive to Qantas management.
They're trying to trim overheads everywhere they can, and that's why they have all new pilots coming into Jetstar on these new agreements, which are significantly cheaper to Qantas than the Qantas mainline pilots are. And then Jet Connect, yep, looks like a Qantas flight, smells like a Qantas flight, paid for via pilots based outside of Australia on totally different rates. So that's the thing they're doing. They've already done it with the, as we reported some time ago, with the Qantas Cabin Crew Australia agreement, where the old guard cabin crew remained on their previous rates and all new cabin crew were brought in on almost Jetstar rates, but they're actually working on Qantas mainline flights. So they've done it with the cabin crew, they're trying it with engineering, and now they're trying it with the pilots as well.
Well, here's what Barry Jackson had to say about the claims for pay that were made by Olivia Wirth earlier on.
Our claim was 2.5%. We had six claims. Those claims that we put across the table were basically to ensure job security for our members. If for example, there is no growth in the mainline, then there is potential for redundancies while we see growth in subsidiaries. So a major concern that the growth will be offshore and offshoring jobs as opposed to Australians who potentially could lose their jobs. This is what this is all about.
Yeah, very interesting stuff. And it's always interesting. I mean, I see this a lot in the industry that I work in, Grant, where obviously management will paint it to the public as saying, well, look, they're after all this extra money, when perhaps that's only part of the equation here. And the way the Qantas Group is set up these days, it's actually a collection of separate airlines. You know, you've got Jetstar and you've got all the offshoots of Jetstar in different parts of the world. And what the Qantas people appear to be looking at here, and we're just seeing this in an article by Steve Creddy in The Australian, it appears that what they're looking for is a more defined career path for Qantas pilots, where they can come in and work in the commuter airlines in any part of the Qantas business, work their way out through Jetstar, and then go on into Qantas mainline. So it's a completely logical career path setup that they're looking for there, in my opinion.
I agreed. It sounds like a really great way to go. You start low, you end up at the top and flying the A380. But the reality is, it's not the way Qantas are going. Since the times of Dixon, Qantas have been changing and changing, and they have become more focused on the bottom line kind of airline. They're ruled by the numbers, whereas you look at some other airlines in New Zealand, for example, the Rob Fyfe method is to say, look after your staff, and if you've got happy staff, they'll go the extra mile to make your customer happy, and a happy customer will come back and spend more money and tell more friends to come back with you, and therefore your bottom line will look good. You've still got to be savvy about business, but it's interesting to see the differences. Sure, Air New Zealand is not perfect and has problems with its staff, but it's quite a different airline the way it's run to Qantas.
So we're looking here at Qantas mainline, about 2,300 pilots, and looking at some of the other news reports we've seen here, it looks like that they're pretty heavily backing the union here. So yes. It is interesting times. Who's right and who's wrong, and how do you strike a balance? Well, that's going to take some very skilled negotiations on both sides, I think. The challenge that Qantas has, and I guess the union as a stakeholder in that has, is that they're trying to operate in a modern environment, but still operate as a legacy carrier, and I imagine that would be extremely difficult to strike that balance.
It does seem that way, mate, and it's going to be very interesting to see how this one comes out, but I think all the indicators are that we're going to have the Qantas mainline pilots going head-to-head with Alan Joyce.
Well, it gives us lots to talk about here on the AusDesk anyway, but we'll end it off here for this week. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarron.
Cheers, folks.
And you can find more of Steve and Grant at plaincrazydownunder.com. Now we have Peter Johnson with his Across the Pond segment for a view of aviation from the European perspective.
There is one threat for every passenger. There is one cloud hanging over our industry, and that is the ripping up of CAP 371 and its replacement with a set of European rules that have little scientific basis and will allow airlines to drive a coach and horses through your current scheduling agreements. The investigation into the horrific 2009 Colgan air incident in Buffalo clearly concludes that the pilot's performance was impaired due to fatigue. The US administration has woken up to that by tightening its rules. Europe is going in the opposite direction.
Here's my view from across the pond. That was Jim McCoslin, General Secretary of the British Airline Pilots Association. Today I want to talk about a piece of regulatory process that seems to go against all the best practice and evidence, and that is EASA's proposals for flight time limitations. In the current climate, where every piece of evidence suggests longer hours leads to greater fatigue in pilots, EASA is proposing an extension, and this doesn't feel right. The federalisation of aviation in Europe is well progressed. Essentially, the problem is that with civil aviation authorities representing each country, European rules were becoming confusing. So a decade or so ago, the Joint Aviation Authority, or JAA, was formed in an effort to join them all together. And so federalisation began. Today in Europe, we're in the process of changing from the JAA to the European Aviation Safety Authority, or EASA. The JAA were never given legal status, and local CAAs were free to adopt or reject any new rules from the JAA. On the whole, though, most were accepted, and in the UK was an early adopter. However, it was recognised that this couldn't continue, so EASA was drafted to replace the JAA, but with legal status. The maximum duty period for UK airline pilots depends on the number of sectors they fly, and in Europe, most of the sectors are quite short. So more sectors equals more work equals more tiring, and that equals a more restrictive duty period. Compounding this is the time when they start. So for instance, an early day start is more restrictive, and generally, normal day times are less restricted. This is all based on science and evidence as to when you will be more alert and able to function more effectively. As an example, current UK rules limit the maximum hours a pilot can operate to 10 hours 15 minutes when reporting for duty at 5:45 in the morning and operating two flights. But EASA plans to increase that to 13 hours 55 minutes. The new EASA proposal would allow discretion to extend duty hours being made by the operator, in other words, the airlines. CAP 371, the UK's regulations, give some protection to airline pilots and has laid the foundations for the UK having the safest aviation in Europe in the past several decades. But what do the new regulations really mean? Well, here are some examples. An airline pilot is currently allowed to fly 900 hours in 12 consecutive months. Under the new regulations, this will increase to 1,000 hours. I know of some pilots hitting these limits now with a busy schedule ahead of them. Today, they'll be restricted from undertaking those extra duties, but if this regulation is adopted in 2012, they will simply be instructed to keep flying. With the decision on extending duty hours in the future resting with the airlines, and with the pressure on the bottom line so great, it's going to be no surprise where the airlines stand on this issue. The Association of European Airlines, which includes British Airways and Virgin Atlantic, are concerned about the regulations, stating that it would add €1 billion to the cost of airlines in Europe, making them uncompetitive. And they are already moving into an argumentative stance with BALPA over the changes. AEA said in a statement, "By publicly implying that some elements of these proposals are unsafe, pilot unions are abusing their role, as well as the esteem that the general public has for airline pilots. It's outrageous that passenger anxiety should be invoked by manipulating facts. To put it bluntly, I sometimes have the impression that the main concern of the pilot union is getting more pilots to fly aircraft so that the unions have more members." However, BALPA doesn't quite share that view. Here's Jim McCausland again.
"Indeed, the available science has been ignored, and the 244-page EASA Notice of Proposed Amendment, NPA, dwells at far greater length on the cost to airlines of adopting CAP 371-type rules. If these proposals are adopted, any airline can choose to fly to these limits, or should I say targets, irrespective of any historical national rules. In reality, UK airlines will struggle to remain competitive unless they join that race to the bottom."
I unashamedly use the UK in this argument to prove a point, not to be parochial about whether this standard is better than anywhere else in the world. EASA's mission statement says, and I quote, "Our mission is to promote the highest common standards of safety and environmental protection in civil aviation in Europe and worldwide." Now, this seems to be at the detriment of a member state having a higher standard of safety and being asked to dumb down to an average standard, which brings poorer member states up to a higher level. I believe that for safety, a zero acceptable level of accidents and a zero level of incidents is the only acceptable indicator. This isn't limited to airline pilots either. The federalisation of European aviation is affecting all areas. For example, a current UK CPL balloon pilot who is qualified to carry fee-paying passengers needs a Class 2 medical. Under EASA's new regulations, they will only require a standard medical similar to an MPPL or a sports pilot licence. Another impact to the standardisation of the regulations is with new pilots from states currently below the UK standards being able to fly anywhere in Europe. GA costs are expected to increase, and in particular, insurance costs. So is the federalisation of Europe aviation a good thing? Yeah, probably. But there lies the challenge. Two steps forward, one back is not an acceptable stance. But then getting around 30 different countries to agree a common standard was recently described to me as like herding cats. So let me know what you think in the show notes or on our Facebook page. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
And thank you, Peter.
You know, every time I hear that expression, I want to acquire a herd of cats to really see what it would be like.
All right, let's move on to some listener mail.
Woo!
Great. Now, last week I forgot one of Vinay's questions for David, but actually David covered that. That was on the Indian aviation, the advanced medium combat aircraft. David kind of talked about that earlier. Vinay also asked about the Junkers F-13. David, are you familiar with that?
I am. The Junkers F-13 was a corrugated aircraft, a very, very early airliner. He asked why that all the southern American countries used them as their startups. Well, the answer is they were cheap and they were plentiful. Junkers built a lot of them. The airlines, and they all sort of, and Germany had such good relations with the South American countries,
right,
to begin with. So that's why they ended up there. But it was a early low-wing monoplane. It was the forerunner of what became the Ju-52, huh, or the anti-Ju, so, or Tante-Ju, if you want to do the complete German. But yeah, it was a very effective airliner, and it was cheap and plentiful. It dealt well in the South American climate. That's why it ended up there.
Makes sense. We also got an email from Jarrett, who was asking about general aviation airports and if we're seeing growth in that area or not. But that's really a question for Rob. And since Rob has kind of bailed on us, we're going to have to defer that question unless anyone else feels comfortable talking about general aviation in the U.S.
No, I say we wait for Rob to not research this and answer poorly next week.
Okay, we'll do that.
I'm sorry.
Although I have seen 16R, and it's which is the movie he was referencing, and it's pretty cool about Van Nuys Airport.
Oh, it's really, really good, and actually, it's on Hulu for free now. So there are ads, but I mean, not very intrusive. So if you haven't seen this movie, go see it.
We also got an email from Jim. Jim says that he works in the insurance industry as a property claims professional for homeowners. And he says, I would love to explore the possibility of getting into aviation claims. Would you mind pointing me in the right direction for looking at this specialized profession? Now, not being an expert in that, first thing that came to my mind is that, yeah, I wonder if there's a professional association that deals with aviation insurance. And it turns out there is the Aviation Insurance Association. And they're at AIAweb.org. So that was kind of the only advice I could pass along. I don't know if anyone else or any of our listeners is knowledgeable in the area of aviation insurance, pass along the information. We also got a letter from Blue747. Show keeps getting better and can't get too long. Any chance you could get Joe Sutter on the program? It would be up there with the Con interview. Now, this, of course, is the he was the chief engineer for Boeing on the 747,
and a guy who got a lot of love today at the 747-8 rollout.
Right now, it might have been an opportunity for us. I don't know how to get in touch with him. So, if anybody knows has any connections,
he has a great book, by the way, on the 747.
Yeah, that's the one with Joe Spencer or Jay Spencer.
Yeah.
Rather the autobiography. Right. That's title that is, I think, 747, Creating the World's First Jumbo Jet and Other Adventures from a Life in Aviation.
Yeah. And the only problem you might have getting him on is Dan probably wouldn't be allowed to be on the podcast that week because he broke that model.
still. Wow.
Has that thing been repaired, Dan?
I ordered new wings for it.
Yeah,
don't
we
know.
Heard that before.
No, I know. But no, well, they came.
And the 787 is still on schedule.
No, but they came, I believe, after I completed my internship.
Ah, okay.
So I have not seen the model since.
And they haven't chosen to tell you that they're satisfied with the repair.
I haven't heard anything, so.
Okay. We got a voicemail from Benet Wilson from Aviation Week.
Hello, airplane geeks. It's Benet Wilson, your little official shot of estrogen on your show. I'm calling. I'm a little behind. I'm just finishing listening to episode 133 with Kelly Jones. And I have to say, I was really impressed to listen to what she had to say about child restraints. As you all know, I have my own little baby airplane geek, and she has been flying since she was 10 days old. And she has always flown. When she was younger, she had a little car seat that stuck on the stroller. Then my parents were kind enough to buy me that stroller car seat from the Sky Mall catalog. Mothers, you have to get this thing. It's fabulous. It's a car seat. It's a stroller. It's FAA approved. And now Clarissa's gotten bigger, so she finally grew out of that, and we bought the Karis restraint system. You can buy this on Amazon. It fits within, just like Kelly said, it fits with the regular airline seat. You just have to flip down the tray in back of you, and Clarissa just loves it. She feels like she's sitting in the big girl seat. I feel safe. She feels safe. And I just encourage parents to just, I know it's tough. We're all financially strapped, but spend that money, buy your child a seat, not only for your own comfort and their comfort, but for safety's sake. That's all I've got. Look forward to the next episode, gentlemen. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Benet. This is an issue that anyone who's traveling with children, flying with children, should be listening to what Benet says, what Jillian Gustafson has told us, and what we've been hearing over and over again with regards to safety restraints for children on airplanes.
But listening to Benet's listener mail made me think, I just wonder if Benet has any thoughts possibly on airlines like Air New Zealand adding voice capabilities, cell phone capabilities to their new aircraft. So, yeah. Just because I know she doesn't care about it at all. So
she doesn't, no?
No, not absolutely. I've never heard a peep from her about it.
Okay. Well, it's always good to hear peeps from Binet, and we'll have to get her back on the show sometime soon. And yeah. To Clarissa, hello from your Uncle Max. We got an interesting email from Jorge. He says, I would like to fly. Now, he's in Key Biscayne, Florida. He says, I would like to fly on an A380 this summer. Which airline carrier flies their A380 from the U.S.? I live on the East Coast. I really don't care where it takes me. The main purpose of the trip is to enjoy the flight. Now, this is my idea of a real airplane geek.
Yes.
Agreed. I love this. This is great.
Yes. So off the top of my head, and fortunately Gavin's here to check me, but you have Air France with the A380 to Paris, but they also announced a while back that this summer the A380 will also be flying from Washington Dulles to Paris. You have Emirates flying the A380 from JFK to Dubai. I think that's it for the East Coast at this point. On the West Coast from LAX, you have Qantas, obviously. Singapore is also going to be bringing the A380 soon. And also, Lufthansa recently announced that their A380s will be flying from San Francisco to Frankfurt. So I think that's everything at this point.
So obviously, Lufthansa and Air France at JFK.
Yeah, it's probably the best bet.
Yeah, I would say, because you could get back to Miami pretty easily from either of those. That's If you're just going for the plane ride, it's a really long plane ride to go all the way to Dubai.
though, if you want to do, I'm not sure how much money Jorge wants to spend on this trip, but if you spend enough money, Emirates first class in the A380, complete with showers. So
not too shabby. Well, Jorge, if you pull this off, we're looking for a trip report out of you. Now, we also got a voicemail from our good friend Steven.
Hey guys, it's Steven in California, just listening to the latest episode of the Airplane Geeks Listener Mail. Quick question in regards to the topic that was just discussed about the, David mentioned the same engines that are on the A-10 are also on the 747. I was wondering, also, if I'm not mistaken, aren't the engines that were on the S3 Viking turbofanned? And if so, does he know, was that the specially made engine for the S3? Or is that one of the engine types like the Pratt & Whitney 4000 or the, I think Max mentioned the GE 6F or some engine like that. I know that IAE V2500 is also used on multiple airplanes. I'm wondering if the same, if the engines that are used on the S3, the turbofans were used on any other aircraft. That's it. So back to the podcast on my drive home, and take care.
So really the A-10 and the 747 don't have the same engines.
Yeah, the S3 and the A-10 do. The GE, I think they're TF-34s.
Right. TF-34 GE-400s.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out how he would have thought that they had the same as the 747.
I think David sort of said that last time.
I said it.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It's your fault.
It's David's fault. But that's okay, because we got it in the end.
Hey, Max.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
Hmm.
If you look under General on Wikipedia,
yeah,
under General Electric CF-34,
right,
a CF-34-8 is mounted on the number 2 pylon of GE Boeing 747-100.
Okay, that's a test. That's got to be a test aircraft.
But that's where I got the screw up.
Okay. So Rich wrote in, I'm still smiling from hearing myself on the podcast this week. Very surreal. Interesting factoid for you. Ryanair only rarely ships freight. I was speaking to a first officer friend of mine who confirmed this fact. It makes sense when you think they don't fly into major airports and removes the responsibility to always be on time. Also explains their love of additional fees. Although I hate him sometimes, Michael O'Leary really does have his head screwed on tight. I think Michael O'Leary really does have his head screwed on tight.
Sometimes a bit too tight.
I like how the FAQ on Ryanair's site is very clear cut here. Does Ryanair carry cargo? No, Ryanair does not carry cargo of any kind. That's it.
Because they only carry self-loading freight.
Though interesting, there is an FAQ. One of the questions on Ryanair's page under the baggage section: does Ryanair carry human remains? And the answer is Ryanair only carry human remains on the London Stansted to Knock route. And then it says who to contact. So I want to know why that's the only route.
Yeah, that is bizarre.
Scratching my head a little bit over that one.
Yeah, I mean, Ryanair, again, they fly an all 737 fleet. And so in terms of they turning the aircraft quickly is a priority. And going back to the whole thing about containerized cargo, with the lack of it on the 737, they really have to make a push and an effort to do that. Otherwise, it just doesn't make a lot of sense for them.
The other thing I have to consider with them is what does adding a cargo infrastructure, was that due to their cost structure?
Oh, 100%.
Which is their biggest thing. But it's interesting, you know, I mean, Southwest, a big low fare carrier here, obviously, they really advertise their cargo service a lot.
Rich also provided a link. Well, I'll put it in the show notes. This is for a trip report to Rome at Easter last year, where their EasyJet A319 landed in a thunderstorm. So Rich has got that up on the LostJohnnies.com site. We'll put a link in the show notes. And we got an email from Paul in Warren, Ohio. Paul is part of a glider club based in Middlefield, Ohio. That's 7G8. Paul says, in our fine club, we have a lot of engineers, a 737 captain, a CFI, power and glider, a glider CFI, a guy that's 20 years old with 500 plus hours of tail dragger time, and other technically oriented talent. Wouldn't it be great to have some of those guys as guests on the podcast? Yes, it would. I think that's a great idea. I think it'd be very fascinating to get some folks who understand gliders who can educate and illuminate the rest of us. So you guys at this glider club in Middlefield, give us a call. Let's see if we can get you on the show. Paul also had a comment about radiation, and we've talked about this in the context of crew going through airport security, you know, many times a week, possibly, and the cumulative effects of radiation, whether that's an issue or not. And Paul says, I can confirm flying from Pittsburgh to Kiev, Russia, you can pick up a 4 millirem of radiation one way. To put this in perspective, the average person in the United States receives an exposure of 300 millirem per year from natural background sources of radiation. And Paul has a link to the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, I think it is, with some data about radiation exposure. And so we'll put that in the show notes as well. And then we got a voicemail from Eric.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. This is Eric in Wichita, longtime listener. I have a question or some advice to seek from you all. Being a fellow airplane geek, most of my leisure time reading involves aviation. Usually it focuses on the airline industry because that's where my main interests are, but of late I've gotten into some history. Right now I'm reading the World War II book, A Dawn Like Thunder by Robert J. Mrazek, and just finished Flight of Passage by Rinker Buck. And then I spend a lot of time with John Nance's airline novels. So just wondered if you guys had any recommendations for what I should read next. As long as it involves aviation and has a good story, I'm usually game. Keep up the good work, fellas, and I hope that this Google Voice message provides a good laugh or two in the translation. I'm a Google Voice user as well, and I always enjoy the translations it gives me. So keep up the good work, and we'll catch you on the podcast. Thanks.
We mentioned the Joe Sutter autobiography previously. That would be a good one. Anybody else got some favorite books?
I have two.
Okay.
One, which I believe is pretty easy to find, would be Gordon Bethune's book, From Worst to First, about the turnaround of Continental. Uh-huh. So that's actually – I read that when I was like around 11 or 12, and that really piqued my interest in the airline industry. The other one, and this one could be difficult to find – but it's called Southwest Passage, and it's written by Lamar Muse, who is one of the original executives behind Southwest Airlines. And he is I just found it to be a very fascinating story. The one issue is it's hard to find. It's no longer print as far as I know. I'm just looking at Amazon, and like a used copy can be expensive just because there aren't a whole lot out there. So that could be a good one to look for if possibly a library somewhere has it. But a very interesting book.
Great. Anybody else? David, did you have some suggested books?
I had four that I recommended. One was Michael Sherry's The Rise of American Air Power, The Creation of Armageddon. The second one was for all of our, I did the review of, I'm not sure which episode it was, but Sam Howe Verhovic's Jet Age and the Comet, the 707. Oh, right. That was a fantastic book. And then I got two biographies. The first one is Robert K. Wilcox's First Blue, the story of World War II ace H. Butch Voris and the creation of the Blue Angels, which is a great story. And last but not least, my favorite aviation biography of all time, Star Smith's Jimmy Stewart, Bomber Pilot. Mm. A must read for any aviation fan, because you think the guy's movie career was fantastic. Wait till you hear what he did with airplanes.
Hmm. Interesting.
One other recommendation that I found interesting. I'm not sure if any of you guys have read it, but Boeing versus Airbus by John Newhouse is an interesting book.
Okay. I have two myself. One is, we actually have several listeners who are writers. One of them is Jamie Dodson, and he writes aviation adventure novels. He has several books out, and I think another one coming out this summer, maybe. And you can find those at www.nickgrantadventures.com. So that's fiction. And then one that I really enjoyed is a book by Captain Terry Rees. This is Flying North, South, East, and West, Arctic to the Sahara. And this is the story about a guy that went to Alaska, became a bush pilot, and that started a career that took him all over the world, ultimately becoming an airline captain. So there's our book recommendations. I think across all of those, there's some interesting stuff there. So I think we ought to wrap it here. I want to thank everyone for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode is Gavin Werbeloff. Gavin, again, thanks for coming along.
Thanks for having me on again, guys.
Travel_Buddha on Twitter, BUDDHA. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. Dan Webb, why don't you start?
If you want to find me, you have to go to your browser and type in thingsinthesky.com. It's not that hard. But is it worth it? Who knows?
We'll let our listeners be the judge.
You can also find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage, because I always enjoy talking to people in 140 characters or less.
Very good. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
I can be found on my blog, whatjustflewby.com. If I finished editing the other 20 minutes left of this episode of Hitchhiker's Guide to Military Aviation, I'll be found there too. And of course, you can always find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof.
Great. And I'll cover for Rob, who had to duck out early. You can find Rob Mark at jetwine.com. And he's also on Twitter as Jetwine. I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory or on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to see airplanegeeks.com for show notes, links, listener comments, and t-shirts. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us to your mobile phone. You can send email to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, there's our listener line, and Binet will tell you the number there.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
You can subscribe to the Airplane Geeks podcast on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, also on BlackBerry. Please leave us a review. We love reviews. Either way, positive, negative, whatever you think, reviews help us a lot, so please do that. Opening and closing music provided by Brother Love. You can find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. And finally, if you'd really, really like to help us out, please be sure to tell your friends about us. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Dan, one other quick thing.
Oh my God.
I'm sorry. I just need to mention this.
Yeah.
Let's talk to Gavin about some of the stuff he's been doing.
No.
No?
Well, I want to talk tired. Because I'm very sensitive.
I thought you had to go grade papers.
Can you
stick around for a few more minutes?
I can stick around for a few minutes because I want to hear Dan be sensitive to Gavin.
Okay.
You know, listening to Who's typing?
Me.
Stop that.
And here's what Captain Barry Jackson from the Australian and International Pilots Association, here's his take on it.
The discussion that was had today is
Barry,
that
you've changed.
2,300 long-haul pilots are absolutely critical to our business.
The Airplane Geeks used to have a Wikipedia page for about a week, I think. I don't know how it got up there, but they decided we weren't big enough or something.
Here's my question, though. Why – sorry, I'm going to have to take a breath so I don't use any expletives. Why does Plane Crazy Down Under still have a Wikipedia page?
Yeah, I don't know.
We have more listeners than them.
Because they're down under. They're north.
They give Australians a break.
Dan, do you want to sit there and update the Wikipedia page?
No, but I'm saying we had one. And I was happy because my name was in Wikipedia. So I thought, you know, it'd be a new way to pick up chicks. But alas, that our page, not important. I don't know who created it, but Play Crazy Down Under, apparently important enough for the generations. So
life's unfair.